You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Ben Mathis here with just a couple of quick announcements before we start the show. We're in the midst of our GoFundMe campaign to cover our production expenses for the coming year. And if you can, I'd like to ask for your help. I'm trying to raise our full production budget for 2016 by the end of this year, pretty much by Christmas time. So if you're enjoying the show, if you're getting something out of all this that I'm doing, then let me know by going to GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics, or you can go on our website at kickasspolitics.com and click the donate button. It's a chance for you, the listener, to participate in what I'm creating here, and there'll be some fun rewards for donating, chances for you to interact with me and the show more, and all sorts of neat stuff. You can give $5 or $500. Every little bit counts, and it shows me that Kick-Ass Politics isn't just falling on deaf ears out there in podcast land. So let me know you hear me. Go to GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics or go to our website at kickasspolitics.com and click on the donate link. Another way you can help out is by going on your Facebook page or Twitter to recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends, followers, minions, or whatever you call those people who like your vacation selfies and comment on your social media rants. And if you do this for me, each week you'll be entered to win a signed copy of a book by one of my recent guests. Now be sure to include a link to the podcast on iTunes so your friends can subscribe, and don't forget to tag us in your posts so we know that you participated and we can include you in that drawing. And if you really want to get ambitious and double your chances of winning, then promote the show on both your Facebook and Twitter. In fact, you'll be entered to win for every time that you recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends on social media. So make your friends my friends. Just help me gain some new listeners, and you'll have a shot at winning a cool prize every week. Thanks a lot, folks. And now, enjoy the show. Hi there. I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. Radical Islamic terrorists taking Christians as their slaves, ragtag pirates seizing U.S. merchant ships, covert operations, U.S. plots to orchestrate regime change in hostile states, and America appeasing her enemies. Sound familiar? Well, I'm not talking about ISIS. I'm not talking about Al-Qaeda. I'm not talking about the Somali pirates. I'm not talking about recent events in Iran, Iraq, or Syria. I'm talking about the oft-forgot chapter in American history called the Barbary Wars, at a time 200 years ago when America was at her most vulnerable. We were heavily in debt to other nations after the Revolutionary War. Our economic fortunes were entirely dependent on our ability to trade with other countries, and we could no longer sail under the protection of the British Navy. In short, American ships were sitting ducks. And North African pirates routinely attacked U.S. merchant vessels, seizing the ships, the cargo, and taking American sailors as their slaves. Tired of getting pushed around, the Founding Fathers, led by Thomas Jefferson, decided to fight back. And what resulted was really the original U.S. War on Terror, and the moment when America first asserted herself on the world stage. It's all in a new book called Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, The Forgotten War That Changed American History, by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. Well, today, Brian Kilmeade's going to join me on the show to talk about it. You know him as the co-host of Fox News morning show Fox and Friends, and host of his own national radio show called Kilmeade and Friends. Guy's got a lot of friends. He and Don Yeager are also the co-authors of their previous bestseller, George Washington's Secret Six, all about the first American spy ring. Today, Brian Kilmeade will talk about the Barbary Wars, Thomas Jefferson as a reluctant hawk who flexed America's military might, a defining moment for the new U.S. Navy and Marines, a daring attempt at regime change, and some very relevant lessons for America's modern-day war with radical Islam. Coming up with Fox News' Brian Kilmeade in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
My guest today is Brian Kilmeade. He's the host of Fox News morning show, Fox and Friends, and the host of his own national radio show, Kilmeade and Friends. He has a new book out called Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, The Forgotten War That Changed American History. Brian, thanks for coming on the show.
I appreciate you having me on, Ben.
Well, Brian, congratulations on your second book now that you've co-authored with Don Yeager. What a fun read this is. I mean, this book reads like a novel or even really reads like a movie. And in reading it, I was thinking back to my American history classes as a kid. I think the Barbary Wars probably only got about a paragraph in the old history books back then. And the subtitle of the book is The Forgotten War That Changed American History. So for those who may not remember this chapter in our history, what were the Barbary Wars?
Well, first off, Ben, congratulations. It's in your book. It's not even in the new books, and it really should be. In fact, when I was talking to some of the experts who were so vital to me to helping us research this book, and I said, I'm going for this information. I said, listen, do a lot of people come to you for this information? He said, before 9/11, absolutely nobody. After 9/11, you wouldn't believe the level of interest. So there's been a few books since then. But it really, think about this for your listeners and viewers. It's the first war on terror against Islamic extremists. They were terrorists. They tried to get their own way, and they used the Quran as their excuse. They said, this is what the Quran says. If you are not a subscriber to Islam, therefore you're an infidel. Therefore, we now have the God-given right to plunder your cargo, take you and enslave you, unless, of course, you want to convert. So we're a young nation. We don't have a problem with anybody. We just want to market our goods and get our economy on its feet. But these nations of Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya, which was then called Tripoli, they have a problem with us. So unless we made peace with them, they would continue to torture our guys and take our cargo. And if you're trying to turn your economy around, it's not a good idea to not have any products at your end game. So our number one customer was Southern Europe. Our number one route was through the Mediterranean. And we were their number one customer. We were the number one victim of these pirate states because we did not have a navy. Hence, we had to come to grips with that challenge and come up with a war plan to challenge these four nations. Yet we had presidents and leaders that didn't want to do it for a great reason. America didn't have the stomach for a long war, John Adams thought. And he thought if we fight them, we have to fight them forever. And we're not really looking to fight somebody forever. We just want to coexist peacefully and let everybody else tear each other apart.
Yeah. And you talk about what a vulnerable spot America was in the years following the revolution and had massive amounts of debt. And we were completely dependent on trade if we were going to dig ourselves out of debt and actually become a real viable nation.
1/6 of our economy went through that area. By the time Washington became president, 20% of our GDP were checks, extortion checks, called tributes back then, to these four nations, along with the gifts that they demanded. They believed America was going to be an emerging nation. They believed that we had an embarrassing amount of riches, and they wanted to take total advantage of it, no doubt about it. And they did for a while. But we were late on our payments. We were late on a lot of our checks. We created a lot of tension. Our ambassadors over there, he wrote all about it, from James Cathcart to Ambassador Eaton at the time. They were called counselors. You had others like Richard O'Brien, who was kept originally was a prisoner for 9.5 years and then became an ambassador over there. They were right about, man, you guys are making it tough for us. Your checks are coming late and the gifts aren't exactly what they want because we were reluctantly doing it. We're a new nation. We're proud, but yet we were writing checks to make sure the bully didn't beat us up. And that changed when Jefferson came into play.
Yeah, and it was interesting. You really get to see kind of the growing pains of becoming a new nation. The good and the bad of independence was that, you know, we were used to being under the protection of the British flag. Suddenly, we're a man, I mean, figuratively speaking, a man without a country. We've got no protector at all.
Well, as Benjamin Franklin would go on to say, if Britain didn't create, if there wasn't a Barbary War, Barbary powers and Barbary pirates, Britain would have done well to actually create one. So they really believed that Britain was behind the egging on of America because we were defenseless. Because what we would do is, they always felt in Britain that it was a freak that we lost, that they lost the Revolutionary War. And that it was just a matter of time before they got back these extremely valuable colonies. So we wanted to put that war off as long as possible. So to put that war off, we wanted to almost ignore the harassment and the seas that they were putting us through. And we wanted to get our own economy going so it would be strong enough to build our own army and navy to hold them off when they were ready. So we didn't even want this fight. So what Britain tried to do is to let them know that there's a good side to being under British rule, and that was protection. But we were too prideful. We'd never go back to what we fought fought for, and that was freedom. And in the end, this war was nestled in between the War of 1812, which was the rematch, and the Revolutionary War.
You know, you talk about how Adams really didn't want to go to war. Jefferson was kind of the lone voice that felt that we should go to war. George Washington was warning against foreign entanglements. He didn't even really think we needed a navy or a standing army. So it took quite a bit of convincing. In the beginning of the book, Jefferson is appointed Secretary of State under George Washington. And really, it's interesting because he was kind of a one-man State Department. He didn't have CIA intel to rely on. He didn't have any research to rely on. He took to his library and started doing his own research on Muslims and on the Barbary pirates and the history going back hundreds of years and corresponding with his counselors on the ground in North Africa. What was it that Jefferson learned in this process that led him to conclude that America could build a modest navy and actually defeat these pirates?
Well, I mean, he would talk to our ambassadors, and one of his quotes was, "I believe with a few frigates and John Paul Jones at the helm, we could wipe out all these pirate nations." William Eaton saw the same thing. He saw them as paper tigers, very tough, very ruthless. But if you fight them, they are not 10 feet tall. That's exactly what our Army, Navy, and Marines have said about ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Take them on. Yeah, they're tough, but we're tougher. We're better. We're stronger, and we have to send a message. And better yet, it's not my choice to send a message. The only thing they will listen to is strength, and they just won't observe strength and think, wow, this guy's got a lot of hardware. They need to know that you're going to use that hardware against them. And when you do that, and you show you're willing to do that, and to be relentless in your quest, that's when they start to break down. And that's what we finally started to do after originally showing nothing but weakness. I think William Eaton said, well, nothing roused my country. And it was very frustrating for people who were over there that we should be standing up for ourselves and telling everyone what it means to be Americans. Instead, we had leaders who didn't want to do that. And a lot of people point to what's happening in the world right now and say, well, that's exactly what we have. We just want to back out and pretend it's not going to be there, stay in our own little nest and let other people kill each other. But that doesn't happen if you're America.
You mentioned William Eaton, who's one of the central characters in this story. And, you know, General William Eaton, I think he's kind of a forgotten name in American history. I don't think most people know his story. Tell us more about him and what seemed at the time perhaps crazy plan that he hatched to defeat our main enemy, which was the Bashar of Tripoli.
Yeah, the Bashar, think of it as a king, a leader, a Dey. There's also that's also considered the leader of the land. So when Eaton is over there, he gets to talking to James Cathcart. And Cathcart tells him, listen, you know this guy in Tripoli, he's crazy. And he doesn't even belong as a leader. In fact, he's the youngest brother. He killed the oldest brother who was sitting there. He was somebody who used to be pliable and dealable. And then the middle brother, he took his family hostage and kicked his middle brother out. And now he took over. You know where his little brother is? Eaton said, no. He goes, he's in Egypt. Maybe you should talk to him and tell him if, you know, use our army, we'll overthrow this guy and put you back in power. Maybe he'll give us his army. So Eaton goes over to Jefferson, says, talk to James Cathcart. We got a great idea. Why don't we just go to Alexandria, Virginia, Alexandria, Egypt, get him, and then march right down into Derna and then take it back and give this guy back the country? He signs a deal saying he's going to be friends with us. What do you think about that? Jefferson says, you're crazy. We're not doing that. So don't ever tell anyone you were going to do that. Forget it. You know, Jefferson says, I'm not going to be able to do this, a covert operation that puts somebody else in power. America shouldn't be in that business. Well, after he gets frustrated for 3 years with his blockade and his naval war, like we get frustrated with our aerial war, he says, I need something different. Go get me William Eaton. He says, William, you still want to do this? He says, yeah. Okay, we never had this meeting. Pretend we didn't. We're going to give you money for 1,000 muskets and $20,000 to go pay for an army and go take it to him. And he lands, and we chronicle it all. He lands in Egypt, goes to seek out Hamid, the deposed leader of Tripoli, and we're going to go put him in our place with 1,000 guns, some ammo, and a whole lot of gumption. And finally, it would be, and also $20,000 to go hire some mercenaries, too. So you got some Italians, some Greeks, as well as just some flat-out mercenaries, as well as the Arabs and Muslims that we had with Hamid. So together, they put together this hodgepodge of an army, and they went to work. And it was anything but smooth. They were turning on each other. No one believed in the mission. They all wanted to cash out, looking to get out. But somehow, someway, William Eaton, with his great leadership skills, they learned mostly under General Mad Anthony, who's an American military legend. He ends up going all the way in and taking Derna in 2.5 hours, led by Marine Presley O'Bannon. Marines fought fearlessly, relentlessly, and in the end, Tripoli was the first nation to fly the American flag because we had defeated it, but had no interest in oppressing its people. We actually gave them freedom.
Yeah, and this is interesting because it's really America's first attempt at regime change. It's our first covert op, and it's the first time the U.S. Marines flex their muscles, really, isn't it?
It is. You know, the Marines, I didn't know this, but during the Navy days, and they're part of the Navy, they would be the security officers on the ship. They'd be bigger and stronger than most. And anytime there was some people upset or they're getting bored or there's fights and drinking, it would be the Marines that had to bring some semblance of security. But when William Eaton needed volunteers to go all this way on this folly of a mission, it was the Marines, nobody else, who stood up and said, count me in.
Yeah, and it's in the song, isn't it? From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. That's this war that they're talking about in the Marine song.
We will fight our country's battles on land and in sea. And that's exactly what we did. And this is the war that they're talking about. And if you look at a Marine in their dress outfits, they have this sword that curls at the end. That sword is not designed by mistake. It was a gift. It was a gift from Hamid, the Muslim leader who's supposed to be back in power, to Presley O'Bannon, because he said, man, you guys fight like nobody's business. Take my sword as a show of respect. That sword became the standard sword for the Marines.
Wow. You talk about how when Eaton goes to Egypt to try and track down Hamid, he has to go into a delicate negotiation with the viceroy of Egypt, who ends up actually being a pretty valuable ally to the U.S. Isn't it an interesting contrast when you compare the viceroy, who was a rational Muslim leader who we could do business with, and you compare him to the Bashar of Tripoli?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what Jefferson said. You know, I could deal with the Turks. They used to be in charge of an empire. What if I have to get their attention, how would you feel about me capturing a few Turks and tell them we're not going to give them back unless we get the Americans back, and the Turks will then come down on the Barbary powers because they're looking to slip away from the Ottoman Empire, but they were still under the auspices and were very much intimidated by Turkey. That's how desperate we got. But when you talk about Hamid was the deposed leader, and he was a pliable guy, not a great leader. William Eaton taught him leadership. His brother Yusef was tyrannical. William Eaton said things that weren't politically correct, called him an animal, a smelly animal that would sit there in what we now call Indian style with his legs crossed and make all these demands while not showering and eating like a slob. And that's William Eaton chronicles it all in a book that he wrote, was written about him, called Life of Eaton. He fully cooperated with, he gave all his letters to, and he sadly died before it could be let out. Now, get this. Eaton dies in 1809. They published the book in 1813. And in November of this year, I was able to find it on eBay and buy it for $112.
Wow.
It should be like $112,000.
Yeah.
Minimum. But nobody knows how special this guy is.
Yeah, he really is a lost in history as an American hero. And it's great that you've kind of brought him back to the forefront. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, I'll talk more with Brian Kilmeade about the outcome of the Barbary Wars and some startling parallels and lessons for dealing with radical Islam in the 21st century. Back in just a moment. If you're enjoying my conversation with Brian Kilmeade, then check out his new book, Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, The Forgotten War That Changed American History. And right now you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates by my guest today, Brian Kilmeade, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics and want to help keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and interesting programs in the future. That's gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. And now, back to the show. We're back, and I'm talking with Brian Kilmeade about his brand new book, Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates. So we're talking about General William Eaton and this mad plan he has to, you know, for the first time in American history, basically overthrow a foreign power and install a friendly government there so that we can freely trade in the Mediterranean. He hatches this great plan. We get to Derna, and Tripoli is within our grasp. We have the Navy blockading Tripoli. Eaton's guys are marching into the region there. They've taken Derna. And then all of the sudden, when victory is right within our grasp, the plan all falls apart. Why did we snatch defeat from the jaws of victory like that?
So, hey, listen, I know this guy's name is Tobias Lear, and he's the one who negotiated the peace. And that's why he was brought over there, to negotiate the peace. And who is Tobias Lear? Longtime aide, trusted confidant to George Washington, who suddenly, mysteriously, became an aide to Thomas Jefferson. Washington and Jefferson, they like to get along great. And it's not unreasonable to think there's something else going on, that they would actually share assistance after his passage. But that's what happened. Tobias Lear is on that ship to cut a deal. So as soon as he lands, we see the big ships. The hope was that Tripoli would say, oh, man, I don't want this fight. Look at the size of those ships and the size of that crew. But they don't care. He ends up saying, ignoring that fact. So in the end, Tobias Lear keeps going ashore, trying to cut a deal, nothing. Then when word comes that William Eaton not only pulled off the impossible, a feat that Jefferson didn't even think was an issue, he just wanted them to have word that we're having a land war to rattle their cage. He had no idea we're about to win the land war. When that happens, you have this Pasha say, okay, let's cut a deal. But the longer that deal took, the more he got a little bit of a bold, and we had to spend about $60,000 to get our guys out, which we didn't have to do, because according to the accounts that we researched of the prisoners who saw Yusef Karman Ali, he was panicking. He says he thought he was going to lose power the next day. Who are these Americans? In 5 years, they strangled our economy, and they're coming for me. And it was all true. Just to finish, he cut the deal prematurely. We still had to pay $60,000. So the $60,000 just came out of the U.S. Treasury. William Eaton feels like a failure. He's told you have 24 hours to get on a ship. He never fulfills his promise to put Hamid back in power. Hamid has to run for his life, and America looks bad internationally.
Yeah, and it starts to sound very familiar, this story.
Yeah.
You know, it starts to sound like Iraq and so many other situations we've dealt with. Well, at the very end of the book, you do end on a high note. Now, that deal that they make ends up being a fragile piece, and we should have learned this lesson earlier from reading the book, you know, from the earlier chapters, but we don't, and we make this deal, and it's a fragile piece, and just a few years later, we end up at war with England and at war with the Barbary pirates. But you end in the book with Stephen Decatur, the naval hero, returns to the Barbary coast with the U.S. Navy, and achieves peace on our terms, peace with honor, so to speak, and then some. What changed by then?
Well, I mean, we have to go for total complete victory. And if you want to know what it's like winning the surge, having the president run on the fact that he won the surge, even though he voted against it, and then giving it all away and pulling entirely out. So what happens is Jefferson has this land war, this naval war, and he pulled all his naysayers and said, this war is going to last forever, and you can't win, Thomas Jefferson. Well, he proves them all wrong. He leaves the office. He had won that war, Louisiana Purchase. Whatever you want to say about his legacy, that war is won. But guess what happens? War of 1812 happens. We take our eye off the prize. We didn't get a complete and total victory. And they start capturing our ships again. Well, when the War of 1812 ends, Stephen Decatur was told, you stay in your uniform. William Bainbridge, you stay in your uniform. You go over there and you tell him, not only do we want our guys back, but we want you to pay us for the inconvenience, like Donald Trump. I want Mexico to build the wall, yeah, and I want them to pay for it. Yeah. By the time it's done, Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, and Tripoli all write us checks for our inconvenience. And we not only get our guys out, we emptied out the prisons for all the guys. And we told them, no more attacking. Pirates are dead. And they pretty much listened.
One thing that I just personally found really interesting about this was, and perhaps it's instructive in our dealings in the region today, is that we were used to fighting the British, who had a strict code of war and played by the rules of engagement. But these Barbary pirates, they had no rules, no honor. And, you know, you talk about how they would lower their flag in defeat, you know, and then take it back, you know, and then raise it back and start attacking
again.
Yeah,
I mean, what you're referring to, and thanks so much for reading the book. So you're in a fight, you're in a fight with another ship, and you blow it away, you knock off their mast, and then, of course, they hang a flag saying they quit. And then when you go to board them and find out what their deal is, it turns out they didn't quit, and they start trying to kill you again. So yeah, this happened two or three times. But that's the mentality of the people we were fighting back then. We had to be better, we had to be stronger, but the rules of engagement allowed it, because they know it wasn't gratuitous.
Yeah, and we kind of had to play their game, didn't we? Because in several of the moments where we engaged them, we flew under the Union Jack until we got just alongside them. Yeah. Then we suddenly lowered it and put up the stars and stripes and launched an attack.
Right. I mean, the Union Jack was somebody they used to leave alone. So they got close when they were just bored and we were about to talk to them. And then all of a sudden the American flag goes up. We start blowing their doors off. So it's genius.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there are definitely lessons there about dealing with people who have no rules. Is it safe to say that if we hadn't had this wake-up call during the Barbary War and started to build up the embryonic stages of a U.S. Navy, we might not have won the War of 1812 against the British just years later?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that. We became very, very proficient in the water. Our ships were fantastic. Evidently, they were quicker and stronger. We went to school on the British, and we said, we're going to have to fight the British. How do we do it? And that's pretty much how we designed the ship. The ship I was on that I have a tour of that fought in this war was the USS Constitution. If you go to briankilmeade.com, it's there. You could also order the book or find out where I'll be. But if you do order that or go to it, you'll see a totally different looking backdrop there.
Would you say that this is a defining moment in America becoming an international superpower, or the beginnings of that?
No doubt about it. And I think the stuff that we drilled with, the mistakes we made, we went to school when it came to going to building the right ships. We went to school when we talked about other nations fighting each other. We knew we were going to pay the price as soon as England made peace with France. For some reason, they spent all their years, my entire youth, fighting each other. And then finally say, listen, let's combine against America. So that's why we didn't have that much success early on in that relationship. But in the end, they may be arguably our best friend in the world.
What do you think are the key takeaways that you want people to get from this that apply to our situations in the region today?
If you go out and pick up Thomas Jefferson, the Tripoli Pirates, you're going to come to conclusion one. Our forefathers had the same problem we had. Number two, they didn't have a ton of revenue, neither do we, to pay our tributes and to pay other people off. Instead, he ended up shipping them down to a guy and getting them raised somewhere else. I also think that when you look at this war on terror, You have to confront it directly and overwhelmingly. We did that early on in Iraq and Afghanistan, but as we sit there and trudge this day in and day out and just try to train a handful of people, we're being abused. So that simply got to change. And standing up to Islamic extremists, that's the only thing they understand. You may not want to. You may think it's a last resort. You may think it's exactly what they want. Regardless, you have to be able to kill them before they kill you. They are not going away. They weren't our idea.
Yeah, isn't it amazing that all these years later, we're still fighting Islamic extremism, we're still fighting terrorists, and we're even still fighting pirates? I mean, Captain Phillips, you know, that was, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, that's one of the things him said I should really do the book. It was 2009, believe it or not, because there's the open seas were lawless. And of course, if you're going to get your ship taken, then you should find out why you don't get guns, allowed to keep guns on the ship. They look for Marines to keep themselves safe. With Captain Phillips, he tried to shoot him with a hose. In the end, those mutants boarded his boat, took him hostage, and they all got blown away, except for one who's sitting in prison wondering what the heck happened to him. He told us he really wanted to visit America. Unfortunately, he's not going to get to visit America.
Well, you know, before we go, I got to ask, you host your radio show and your TV show, I think, 5 days a week here. How did you find the time to write this amazing book?
Over 4 years, we have a chance to do it in compartmentalization. What you do is you do it in steps. One, you get the deal. Number two, then you write the summary. Then you come up with the chapter ideas. And then you write the summary for each chapter. And then you break out each chapter. And then you bounce it off each other. And instead of looking at it as I have a book due, I had small goals. So I was able to budget around my time and think to yourself, it's all got to come together by June. And then we have a great editor who was able to put it all together and make it into one flowing voice. And I think we finally got that.
Okay. Bit by bit. Baby steps. Well, again, the book is Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, The Forgotten War That Changed American History. Like I said, I loved it. I thought it read like a movie. You know, any talk of someone doing a movie of this? I think they should.
Let's do it. Let's spread the word.
Who would you casting? Any ideas?
Well, I just know I'm going to start with Bradley Cooper and all his friends. And then we'll work our way back. I love what he did with American Sniper. And that's what's going to take the show. A great warrior who's also got movie star looks, who happens to be a movie star.
Yeah.
And that's why I'd go with him.
Who would you cast as Jefferson and Eaton?
That's a good question. Is Eaton Mike Ditka in 19, when he was in his prime, I think? Yeah. I would think a tough talking, you just need a tough talking, blunt speaking guy to play Eaton. He's one of the ultimate, one of the our ultimate leaders of the time. I have to give it some thought before I cast it.
Well, I hope that there is a movie of it, because this is just a fun story. If you're a history nut, even if you're not a history nut, it's great. It's applicable to everything going on. It's even great, I think, for young people. I think it's appropriate and fascinating. It's a great Christmas gift. Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, The Forgotten War That Changed American History. Brian Kilmeade, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. And if you go to briankilmeade.com, you can find out how to get it personalized or signed or sent. So thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Fox's Brian Kilmeade for coming on the show to talk about his new book, Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, The Forgotten War That Changed American History. You can watch Brian Kilmeade every weekday on Fox and Friends or on his radio show Kilmeade and Friends on the Fox Radio News Network. And you can order Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager on Amazon. So I'll include a link in the show notes for this episode, as well as on the website at kickasspolitics.com, where you can order it. It's also available for audiobook and Kindle, so definitely check it out, and it makes a great Christmas gift. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a review. The other thing you can do to help the show is to go on your Facebook page or Twitter to recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends and suggest that they subscribe. And if you do that, each week you'll be entered to win a signed copy of a book by one of my guests on the show. So be sure to tag us when you do so. You can tag us on Twitter at @KAPolitics, or our Facebook page is just Kick-Ass Politics. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, gripes, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. In the next episode, I'll talk with Garry Kasparov. He spent 20 years as the number one ranked chess player in the world, and he's widely considered to be the greatest chess master of all time. But in 2005, he set aside his chessboard to take up the cause for democracy in his native country of Russia. Over the past 10 years, Garry Kasparov has become Vladimir Putin's harshest and most high-profile critic, and the de facto leader of the opposition movement against Putin. He has a new book in which he warns that Russia under Vladimir Putin represents not just a threat to Russia's neighbors, but a global danger to all free countries of the world. Coming up in the next podcast with Garry Kasparov. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.